Now, many of you know that all academic talks, in point of fact, are infomercials. They intend to sell you something, whether it's an idea or, in this case, a book. This book literally just appeared last week, and I'm very pleased with it. Andy Robinbach and Princeton and I have been working on it for about 14 years. And the reason I wanted to present it first here at the Freud Museum is that it is the first attempt to integrate, using primary materials, the story of psychoanalysis between 1933 and 1945 in Germany. This is certainly not the first volume of primary sources to appear in English. George Mossi's great collection of the 1970s. This is the most extensive one, and it's the first, I think, to take quite seriously the role that psychology and psychoanalysis played within Nazi Germany. And what I want to do today is really sort of present the material that we present and tell you the story that we hope that the reader of this volume will get reading the materials from the time. It really is important to understand what we want to do is to give readers an unmediated access to the way that psychology, and very specifically psychoanalysis, was understood from 1933 to 1945 in Germany. Now, let me begin by saying that one of the things that is important to understand about National Socialism is that it is a program without an ideology. In other words, it's not like communism. It's not even like fascism. National Socialism was driven by the moment and the idiosyncratic interests and conflicts of its leadership cadre. And those interests and conflicts meant that things could shift radically from one moment to the other. The only constant under National Socialism, the only constant was racism. And racism in its basic form, articulated in the form of anti-Semitism. And anti-Semitism, again, being a very broad, all-inclusive term that would include, for example, from the Nazis' perspective, things like anti-Bolshevism. In other words, their criticism of the Soviet Union is, in point of fact, a criticism which is racial rather than, can we say, political or ideological. Now, one of the things that we have to understand, and I say this sort of as a moment of introduction, is that from the very earliest reactions to his work through the time of his death, Sigmund Freud was excoriated as a racial Jew. The word Jew has many, many meanings in the 19th and 20th century. But the core one has nothing to do with religion, has nothing to do with history, it has to do with biology. That's very difficult for us in the 21st century to understand. But when people said that Freud was a Jew, and that Freud thought like a Jew, that was a comment about race biology. And Freud, by the way, was quite attuned to it. In my book, Freud, Race and Gender, I make the argument, I hope compellingly, that one of the things that Freud, starting as a medical student in Vienna, because we have his textbooks with his notes, has to argue against within 19th and early 20th century medicine is that the core of that medical profession, the core of medicine, was racial anthropology. Now again, that's very difficult for us to imagine. Freud understood it, and he understood it, by the way, better than most in his time. Right? Now, saying that Freud rejects the label of racial biology as a Jew doesn't mean, I stress this over and over again, that he ever
rejected the idea that he was Jewish, ethnically or culturally Jewish. Certainly not religiously Jewish. But those are different categories from racial biology. Now, in a real sense, our story begins on May the 10th, 1933, in Berlin. The week before, the SA had raided Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Sciences. Hirschfeld, luckily, was in Paris at the time. And they basically destroyed the institute, and they stole books from the library, and the books were going to be part of a great public event. The Nazis are big about public events and propaganda and visual moments. The purging of the German collective soul from the Jews. One of the observers noted that it was clear from their profanity that the students were familiar with the names of many authors represented in the special library. Not only did they refer to Sigmund Freud, whose picture they removed from the stairwell and carted off as the dirty Jew Sigmund Freud, they also called Havelock Ellis the pig Havelock Ellis. So one of the things you have to understand is that in 1933, psychoanalysis is Jewish, meaning racially Jewish, and it is associated with a whole range of political positions that we talk about today as modernism. It is the antithesis of the folk, of the people, of the race, and Freud is one of the key icons of that. Freud and Einstein, as you well know, are the best-known Jews in the world in 1933. Everybody recognizes Freud's name, and obviously also his picture. Everybody recognizes Einstein's name and his picture. One of the things we did in putting this together was to take a look at how psychoanalysis becomes part of an attack on what the Nazis call the Jewification of the German soul. Psychoanalysis, and this is in an anonymous essay published in September of 1933, psychoanalysis is an impressive example of the fact that nothing good for us Germans can ever come from a Jew. Now, those categories are racial categories, even when he produces scientific achievements. Even if he gave us 5% that was novel and apparently good, 95% of his doctrine is destructive and annihilating for us. His own fellow Jews and other races may derive advantage from Jewish ideas, but we Germans and all peoples with Nordic blood always finds that it turns out badly for us when we eat anything out of the Jews' hand. Now, this is state propaganda. The idea is that the Nordic people, the Aryans, are a race. They have a soul, a psyche. The Germans, too, understand that the Jews are a race, but they are destructive when, in point of fact, they are present within the German body politic. Psychoanalysis becomes, in a sense, that space now where the Jew exists in German thought. The author, this anonymous author, goes on talking about psychoanalysis as therapy. Psychoanalysis aims to be a method of cure for certain nervous conditions, neuroses, that have occurred because of inner conflicts in the instinctual life. In the mind of man, often to an advanced age, there is a constant struggle between good and evil, between the instincts of reproduction and self-preservation on the one hand, and the divine blood-linked ego on the other. In racially superior people, this struggle ends quite naturally with the victory of the ego, with the instincts overcome and controlled. For in superior people, the Germans, the conscience watches over every false step, whether sexual or social. It points out to the individual, here you have done wrong, and the strong man takes this as a warning for the next time. The strong man is, of course, the German, the weak man, the Jew. Psychoanalysis is a Jewish science because it deals with the weaknesses of the Jews, a people without conscience. Again, what's really interesting, because, you know, we don't think of the politics of this as being permeated with a kind of internalization of the understanding of the psyche, which by 1933 is, can we say, a commonplace, not only in Germany, but in the whole Western world. What is fascinating is that in order to explain German souls, the anonymous author uses a model, which is a point of fact, a psychoanalytic one. And that's one of the things that becomes very interesting. The sort of notion that what you do is you can use the enemy's language, the Jew's language, as a way of understanding the Jew's pernicious space within German culture. Now, at exactly the same moment, and again, if you're going to complain, by the way, that the Nazis are inconsistent, you're right. The Nazis are inconsistent. That's why I said they don't have an ideology. They do have this sort of fascination with racial biology. Frank Baron in the Berlin Börsenzeitung in 1933 talks about the relationship between psychoanalysis, now not the Aryan German Nordic, but Christianity. First it was psychoanalysis, he writes, with its claim to be a new doctrine of salvation for sick minds that attacked Christianity, declared religion to be out of date, and shows itself as its appointed successor, as the contemporary fulfillment of the religious mission of mankind. It could point to the fact that sexuality, the focus of Freud's work, also has a place in Christian thought as the concept of the sins of the flesh. The psychoanalyst wanted to be distinguished from the theologian only because he approaches this concept in a concrete form and searches out every path of this sin, even in its most secret way. One of the things that is fascinating is how the Nazis, and here we're talking now about, in a sense, Nazi public relations, begin to think about how their enemies are going to be defined. Is Christianity, in a sense, something to be Aryanized? Alfred Rosenberg thought it would be. You have to get rid of Jesus the Jew. Or, in point of fact, as many of the people in the German Foreign Service understood, alliance building with the Vatican, alliance building with the German Evangelical National Church was more important than trying to create a new religion. But whatever that new religion was going to be, new forms of the old, development of a new pathway, it was, in point of fact, the antithesis of psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is, in a sense, the pre-Pauline or post-Freudian. It is that world which the Nazis dismiss. Freud, and here is Kurt Gauge in October of 1933, speaks of overcoming the pleasure principle. But he cannot name the value system that can be experienced only outside of every egoistic evaluation. Such a system of values is possible only as an expression of a worldview that does not have the individual and his well-being as the as its exclusive goal. However, hitherto, psychotherapy was largely individualistically oriented, and precisely at this point where one spoke of the relationship of the individual to the community. To us, the concept of the individual is at onset false. It is the expression of an attitude that we call liberalistic. Because in point of fact, the individual could only be understood as part of the folk, as part of the collective. By the way, the collective as Germans, or the collective as Jews. Right? As inheritors, Gauger goes on, of the individualistic epoch, we know much about individual conditions of mental illness. What we did not hear so much about, however, before Adolf Hitler, are the general conditions of the health of the soul. Adolf Hitler did not start out from purely economic considerations. And the argument always is First World War, depression, inflation. No. He did not promise his first followers, and later the whole German people, more earnings and less work, as had been done earlier by Marxist demagogues. He promised us nothing. He achieved something psychologically unprecedented in that he made demands rather than promises. Demands of whom? The folk. Now, again, it's very difficult to put ourselves into this mindset because this idea of the racial collective is not an invention of 1933. It's a very old set of presuppositions, certainly going back to the Enlightenment, going back to the 18th century, not only in Central Europe, but in Western Europe, in Britain, and certainly in North America. The question always is, how does this community constitute itself? The big debate, it's an interesting debate in the Enlightenment, is natural characteristics something which is inherited, biological? That is, does the son of a Scots man and woman automatically become a Scots man or woman? Is it cultural? Did anybody move to Edinburgh and become a Scotsman? Is it, in point of fact, culturally determined or biologically determined? Is it malleable or is it permanent? The Nazis work on the assumption that race and the soul of the folk, and they use that phrase over and over and over again, Volksseele, the soul of the folk, of the people, of this racial collective, is in point of fact homogeneous, really important, homogeneous, and has its expression through the individual members of that racial collective. This is, we know, a fantasy of purity. In a world, by the way, in which not only the Jews, right, are a foreign element not belonging to the Volksseele, but in fact, Germans themselves are an invention. An invention of the Enlightenment of the 19th century, and then very much an invention of Bismarck's empire. Because what he had to do was to get Catholics and Protestants who hated each other almost as much as each of them hated the Jews to start to think of themselves as a member of this folk. Now, Bismarck understands that the Jews can be integrated. He has no problem with that. But the racial thinkers in the late 19th century argue exactly the opposite. Biology trumps culture. Now, this is an old argument. And one of the things we have to understand is that it is argued well before the Nazis take over. Now, we know that Freud's initial followers in Vienna, because the politics of race in Vienna are perhaps the exemplary case of how racial biology becomes politics, becomes science, that most of Freud's clientele were Jewish. By 1910, he had confronted his Viennese Jewish colleagues, the Second Psychoanalytic Congress, and stated the case bluntly. Most of you are Jews, and therefore you are incompetent to win friends for the new teaching. Jews must be content with the modest role of preparing the ground. It is absolutely essential that I should form ties in the world of general science. The Swiss, boy was he wrong on this one, the Swiss will save us. Now, it was, of course, Carl Gustav Jung that he's talking about. But Jung eventually came to see Freud's formulation of psychoanalysis as a Jewish science and stressed the difference between a Jewish collective biological psychology and an Aryan one as early as 1918. He didn't need the Nazis. Right? This view is a 19th century view which Jung picks up, doesn't originate it, picks up and simply assumes Volksseele, right? Cultural, not at all biological, a Jewish one and an Aryan one. Jung criticizes the rootlessness of the Jew. The fact is in 1918 that he is badly at a loss for that quality in man which roots him to the earth and draws new strength from below. Right? This is this idea of the Volksseele connected to what? The earth, the space. The phrase that I always use, because it comes out of the origin of the ecology movement, green they were, is races in their appropriate spaces. The Swiss belong in the mountains, the Jews belong in the deserts. This view of the rootlessness of the Jew made the Jew's creativity, especially in the sphere of psychology, of value only for the Jew. Thus it is quite an unpardonable mistake to accept the conclusions of a Jewish psychology, Freud, as generally valid. In 1934, he repeats this. And I won't read the whole passage, I'll just read you a bit of it. The Jewish race as a whole, at least this is my experience, Jung writes in 34, possesses an unconscious that can be cared with the Aryan one only with reserve. He did not understand the Germanic psyche any more than did his Germanic followers, he's talking about Freud, as the formidable phenomenon of National Socialism, in which the whole world gazes with astonished eyes, as positive, not negative, taught them better. Where was that unparalleled tension and energy while as yet no National Socialism existed? Where was it? In the Volksseele, deep in the Germanic psyche, in a pit that is anything but a garbage bin of unrealizable infantile wishes and unresolved family resentments. A movement that grips a whole nation must have matured in every individual as well. This is 1933-1934. The Nazis take over. The Nazis are a collection of people interested in their, can we say, own establishment of power. That's what they're interested in. They espouse a racial biology. And a whole bunch of intellectuals, this is, by the way, always the problems with intellectuals, look at this purely political movement and say, this is the truth. Why? Because this is what I have always believed. Jung is just one of them. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of major thinkers. Legal scholars like Carl Schmitt. Great poets like Gottfried Benn. Who say in 1933, this is the truth because I have always believed it. And of course there is no better example of that in 1933 than Heidegger, the philosopher. Jung broke with Freud, as you know, and undertook the editing of a major psychotherapeutic journal from 1928 to 39. The Zentralblatt, the organ of the General Medical Society of Psychopathology, was published in Leipzig and co-edited by Jung, and now I'm going to introduce, in a sense, the next player, a psychoanalyst by the name of Matthias Heinrich Göring. It was Göring who, and I hope you notice the quotation marks, rescued psychoanalysis in Germany. Now, as many of you know, Jeffrey Carks, already in the 1980s, wrote about the so-called Goering Institute. And what we wanted to do was to explore a little bit about how this institute was sold to the German public. In 1933, the Nazis had declared psychoanalysis a Jewish Marxist piece of obscenity. And that was on a good day. Right? A cousin of the Reichsmarschall, who was then the Prussian state president, Hermann Göring, and an officer in the Luftwaffe, Matthias Göring Aryanized psychoanalysis by placing it in the service of racial theory. In other words, he did what Jung had espoused already in 1918. He's a trained lawyer and neurologist. He underwent analysis with the Adlerian psychotherapist Leonard Self in Munich as part of his training in 1928. Göring stressed, and this is prior to the Nazis, community feeling. And that's a phrase you have from Adler. But of course, when Adler uses it, he's talking about social network. When Göring uses it, he's talking about the Volksseele. Right? Which he defined, unlike most Adlerians, in terms of nationalism and Christian belief. His Deutsches Institut für Psychologische Forschung und Psychotherapie, founded in 1936 in Berlin, racialized psychoanalysis, destroying Freud's legacy in order to save psychology. If, as the Nazis argued, mental illness was a sign of the degeneracy of a race, Göring proposed that the truly Germanic art of Seelenheilkunde, a really important word of the early 19th, actually of the 18th century, but becomes very important in the early 19th century, with its German romantic roots, was the only appropriate means of dealing with mental illness of a superior race. Pragmatic to the hilt, the Göring Institute placed psychotherapy in the service of the new state. The promises were clear: to make the mentally ill quickly able to return to full function as productive members of the state, to cure homosexuality, and in general, improve the health of the race. I'm going to stop here for a minute. Because again, what we do usually is to retrospectively look at the Nazis and say, the Nazis hate a whole group of minorities. They see them as burdens on the state. They see them as useless members of society. Indeed, they use the term parasite for the Jews, right? For the mentally ill, for the homosexual, for the blind, for the deaf. But I always look for the footnotes. So, for example, by 1935, the Nazis had reorganized all of the youth groups in Germany into three groups. A group for boys, the Hitlerjugend, a group for younger women, the Bund Deutsche Mädel, and then a group for older women, which is not going to be of much interest for us, women in their 20s. And everybody joined. Everybody wanted to join. Every school wanted to have a group of, let us say, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, so that everybody could be a member of this collective. The students in the Braille Institute for the Blind in Berlin petitioned the government whether they could have an organization of the Hayat and Bund Deutsche Mädel at the Braille school. Well, I mean, we can't have that because, well, I mean, blind kids are clearly a burden, a parasite, right? But here again, this odd slipperiness, this absence of ideology and the kind of pragmatics. One of the things that was decided was, let's talk about the blind and the blind. Let's talk about inherited blindness and non-inherited blindness. And if it was non-inherited blindness, kids got their uniform, and they got a special badge which says B for blind, or deaf, right, or crippled. In other words, we would find it difficult to imagine a healthy, pure race in which some of the healthy, pure racial individuals are blind or deaf or disabled. The Nazis managed that. Homosexuality, the same thing. Depends who's homosexual. Depends how it can be cured. The Nazis believed, by the way, that most homosexuals were, in point of fact, can we use the phrase incidental homosexuals? They've been made homosexuals by being seduced. It's, the model is the vampire, right? Vampire bites you, you become a vampire. Homosexual bites you, you become a homosexual. Goering thought he could cure this. There are groups in the United States who think they can cure it. Right? So it's very important to understand that this competition for cure within the body politic is one of the things that begins to drive psychoanalysis. The mentally ill are not a uniform category. They, in point of fact, have to be divided into that group which are inherited mental illness, whatever that means, by the way. These are made-up categories, obviously. And those which are acquired mental illness, and that can be cured, and the people can be restored to healthy membership in the body politic. Now, Goering is a really interesting figure. He's an interesting figure in the Third Reich, and by the way, since he continues to practice in Germany after the end of the Third Reich, and is one of the leaders in the German psychoanalytic movement after 1945, is also an important figure to think about in terms of what happens to psychoanalysis when it is reintegrated into world psychoanalysis. There's an interview with him which we uncovered in 1939, which, again, this is in the Völkische Beobachter, which is the official Nazi newspaper. This is a way that the Goering Institute is now being sold to the general public, right, through Nazi media. The Institute in question is also committed to research, whereby the search for solutions has become one of the fundamental concerns. And ever since Freud, the field has also been a domain reserved almost exclusively for Jewish doctors. And that is why, already decades ago, there was a purely instinctive, again, remember, racial biology, instinctive rejection among Germans of Freud's doctrine, which is based slowly on the development of the sexual apparatus. Now, Goering is going to create now a new archaeology for the new psychoanalysis that brackets Freud, that brackets Vienna, that brackets the Berlin psychoanalytic. We have Leibniz to thank for our knowledge of the forces lying dormant in the unconscious, and the physician Carl Gustav Karas, Goethe's friend, and Baron Ernst von Feuchtesleben, who wrote 100 years ago in his slim volume zur Diathetik der Seele, the basis for life is the unconscious, the creative forces of emotion and of the imagination. For the Jews, and this is Goering, 1939, psychotherapy became a business. The putrefaction of the soul and an inevitability that required an antidotal purification as the next step. But today, psychotherapy has established itself as a thoroughly German form of psychoanalysis. Understand what that means. It means it is appropriate for the Volksseele. What Jung says in 1918, what Goering says in 1939. But Goering also understands that human sexuality is something that can simply not be dismissed. That debate about Freud versus psychoanalysis versus Christianity, Freud versus Jesus, has to do, or perhaps versus Paul, has to do with the acceptance or rejection of the notion of sexuality as an underlying force. What Goering does is, in a sense, both brilliant and typical of the 1930s and 1940s. Because one of the things that that idea of creating a healthy folk, Seele, does, is in point of fact to figure out that the way you can do this is through hygiene. And again, hygiene is this really important 19th century concept. Right? Hygiene is a type of purification. The model for it, which is biological, comes out of, it's older than, but is impacted by the rise of bacteriology. Right? Wash your hands after you go to the bathroom, my mother always said. I try to remember that every time I go to the bathroom. Right? The interest of public hygiene and health, Volksgesundheit, is greatly served by the work of the family physician who makes regular house visits, even when there is no immediate ailment to be treated. It is absolutely essential that the physician also receive psychotherapeutic training so that he is able to support the parents and mothers especially with his advice and services, providing for monitoring not only the physical development of the child, but also for its psychological development. This is a particularly important to prevent therapies. But what could possibly be more satisfying than preventing illness, pain, and suffering, and with comprehensive care to make a substantial contribution to this cultivation of a healthy generation of Germans? Even child psychoanalysis, child psychotherapy, is added to the repertory now of the Nazi physician. Now, as is obvious, most German psychoanalysts had left Germany before and after 1933. Many of them, by the way, because they were Jewish. Some of them, like Wilhelm Reich, because they were Jewish and left. But also, some of them because, in point of fact, they were simply psychoanalysts who were neither left nor Jewish. One of the things one has to understand is that psychoanalysis becomes, in a sense, a targeted group. First of all, in 33 in Germany, and then in 38 in Austria, psychoanalysts become, in a sense, an extension of the stereotype of the Jewish therapist. Freud is the Jewish therapist. And one of the stories that we tell in the book, because it's a very, very important story to understand, is the story of Edith Jacobson, because we all know her under that name, Edith Jacobson. Now, Edith Jacobson became part of the organized opposition to the Nazis in 1933. And there was an organized opposition. It was sporadic, some of it driven by the communists, some of it by social democrats, some of it by independent groups. The White Rose Group, for example, of students and teachers in Munich is a great example of that. Jacobson had trained in the most political of the psychoanalytic institutes, and that was the Berlin Institute in 1925. And she fled Berlin in 1933. She helped, she returned in order to help organize an opposition group called Neubeginnen, which was referred to in the time as the Org, the organization. Arrested in 1935, she was placed in a Berlin jail rather than a concentration camp. Her supporters accused the International Psychoanalytic Association of timidity in protesting her incarceration, a charge refuted by Ernst Jones, the organization's director. As Jacobson recounted in her 1948 memoirs, she had relatively good conditions and was able to manage and escape from the jail when a former member of her group arranged for her to be released for health reasons. One of the things we bring in the source book are the documents to this story. So we have, for example, the official indictment, December the 5th, 1933. The neurologist, Dr. Edith Jacobson, was taken into contemporary custody in October 35, held for interrogation. This matter in Berlin Moabit. She is charged with having participated in preparations alone with others for the treasonous attempt to violate the constitution of the Reich through the use of force, whereby motive for the crime was to secure and sustain organizational cohesion in preparation for an act of high treason. And that's the indictment, and that's an early portrait of Edith Jacobson. And Buchholz writes a round-robin letter to all international psychoanalysts. It's been 8 months since Edith Jacobson was arrested by the state secret police in Berlin. For the past 8 months, she's been sitting in prison and has not yet been given a trial. At the beginning of this tragic occurrence, the international psychoanalyst demonstrated interest and willingness to help. Sheer indolence and bad advice from that timid Berlin group, among them Göring, helped them from undertaking any concrete measures. The Berlin group, under the direction of von Böhm and Müller, had been Nazified and identified with National Socialism, despite the fact that the founders of the psychoanalysis they now practice were Jews, as are most of their active practitioners. Are we to allow the fear-ridden atmosphere around the Berlin group to result in Edith Jacobson having to sacrifice perhaps years of her life and her freedom? Every analyst is hereby requested to reflect for about half an hour on the conditions in a German prison. Ernest Jones replies, this is a round-robin letter also, a public letter, and I'm going to read you just bits of it. Jones being the president of the International. I cannot find your action in appealing to the members of the International to bring pressure to bear via me was a very friendly one. Had you done me the courtesy of first notifying me of your intention, I would have had the opportunity of correcting some serious misstatements. It is not true, as you imply, that the International showed interest and willingness to help only at the beginning. You are evidently uninformed about what they are still doing, showing. It is not true that we have been kept back from concrete action by any advice on the part of the timid Berlin group. When I journeyed to Berlin in connection with the Jacobson case, I interviewed her own lawyer and friends. We agreed on a plan of campaign best calculated to serve her interests, which you all have at heart. If you have any definite proposals for furthering these interests in any other way, there are many people who would be grateful to listen to them. But speaking for all of whom I've consulted, I feel that any attempt at a publicity campaign in the press would greatly worsen her chance of freedom and would seriously injure her interests at a time when they are hanging in the balance. That's what he says. This is the public letter. But he also then writes a private letter to Anna Freud on the 2nd of December, 1935. Now, Anna Freud is, of course, in Vienna. I want to read you bits of it, because the letter is actually quite revealing. Also revealing about this is up through the Nuremberg Laws, between 33 and 35. Many people, I'm not going to say most people, expected the Nazis to be a flash in the pan, that the government was going to collapse, as, by the way, every government had collapsed in the Weimar Republic after a very short period of time. By 1935, by the way, it was clear that was not going to happen. But many people sort of assumed that this was a, you know, just if you just keep your mouth shut, they're going to go away. She's well-treated and has her food at a choice from a restaurant, can read and write everything and receive visit. I greatly wanted to visit her myself, but this would have meant staying 2 days longer in Berlin. The prosecuting attorney has decided that all other people concerned are to be charged with high treason. Though he has read the files, he has not decided whether there's enough evidence to make worthwhile to charge her as well. If not, she will probably be set free in a few days' time. There would be then a considerable probability of the Gestapo, and this is a really interesting phrase, because this is pure Nazi speak, educating her in a concentration camps. Concentration camps were set up very early on, Dachau being the first one, and they were for political re-education. Right? They were for political re-education. This is not a death camp, right? These are the concentration camps, which become, in the course of the 30s, de facto death camps. Kussmann of the Institute has purposely refrained from asking for the Akten and therefore knows very little about the details. He has heard nothing about any question of patience, though that many, of course, may be included, but only that she lent her rooms for meeting of politically underground people. It seemed unlikely that this could be anything very serious unless she is quite crazy. I mean, you know, that's why we want people to read the original documents. I mean, that's a really interesting statement. I mean, she would be quite crazy if she actually opposed the Nazis and wanted to overthrow them. 1935. Now, Göring led the drive to incorporate the Deutsche Psychoanalytische Gesellschaft into his German Institute for Psychological Research in 36. The German psychoanalytic was officially disbanded in 38, at which point classical psychoanalysis ended in Germany, despite efforts by the head of the International, Hans Jones, who was less concerned about the German-Jewish analysts who were to be expelled from the organization, most of them had left already by 38, than about preserving a semblance of psychoanalysis in any new organizations. In his letter to Freud, Jones explained that he opposed the resignation of Gentiles from the German Psychoanalytic Society in sympathy with the Jewish analysts. And again, I wanted to read you just a bit of this. And this is Jones again. The society was unanimous in the manner of expelling the Jews, and it was unfortunate that I used up so much energy about it, because one diminishes one's influence if one uses energy in a hopeless cause. I would not have done so had I known the facts. On the previous evening, there had been little mention of the question, it being left in my interview with the Jews, and also because on the day before, a unanimous conclusion had been come to by both the Jews and Gentiles together that they would resign at once, the Jews would resign at once, so the matter was regarded as settled and not one about which to ask my opinion. However, he says, upon hearing that I was coming, the Jews made a complete volte face and presented me with some very good arguments about why the present moment could be a very inopportune moment for such an action. You could also see certain dangers it might have for the society itself. So I proceeded to the general meeting and put the case strongly, evidently to the great astonishment of the Jews, who thought the question had been settled. This was part of bad staff work on Böhm's meaning. Part who was present in my interview with the Jews, neither asked them the meaning of their change of opinion, nor informed me that there had been such a change. Müller Braunschweig is busy coquetting with the idea of combining a philosophy of psychoanalysis with a quasi-theological concept of National Socialist ideology, and you can imagine that this is a very busy occupation. No doubt he will proceed further along these lines, and he is definitely anti-Semitic, which Böhm is certainly not. Now, this is pragmatic. This is very pragmatic. Psychoanalysis has to be preserved. The question, of course, is, by 1935, preserved in what form? Right, Göring, in a sense, takes psychoanalysis into his new Nazi psychology, psychology of the Volksseele, looking at collective health, right, reforming the individual and making the collective healthy. Psychoanalysis, in a sense, in a real sense, disappears in spite of Jones and not because of Jones. I want to end, as I began, by noting that Freud, of course, had been damned as a Jew, a racial Jew. Though he, rejecting all religious identity, maintained his Jewish identity both privately and publicly. In 1939, the obituary of Freud by Fritz Bleiber is revealing in the Nazis' relationship to this legend of Freud. This is, by the way, one of the few obituaries of Freud. One of the great contributions of the famous racial researcher H.K. Günther is the revelation that feelings of guilt are the quintessential emanation of the Jewish racial soul. Right? The consciousness of sin that has become increasingly widespread among the Jews ever since the time of Nehemiah had found palpable expression through Sigmund Freud. I'm going to come back to that. Just one look at him tells us it is written all over his face. When he and his movement were described as a slave revolt of immorality, a statement made, incidentally, by one of his racial comrades, Egon Friedel, then there is little more than we have to add. Psychoanalysis, 1939, is never going to be acceptable, whether whitewashed by Göring or not. Sigmund Freud, the name that Sigmund Freud was given at birth, is a code. Why does Sigmund Freud change his name to Sigmund Freud? Well, because in the jokes of the late 19th and early 20th century, the classic Jewish figure is always the little Sigmund. That notion of joy of the racial soul, the Jewish racial soul, becomes part and parcel of the legacy of psychoanalysis. One of the reasons we wanted in the Third Reich source book to have a section on this debate about the German soul and the Jewish soul is that those debates are part and parcel of a larger structure. One of the structures that I think really the major, perhaps only structure, that offers any coherence to the period 1933 to 1945. It's not a footnote. The story of psychoanalysis and psychology in Nazi Germany is part and parcel the story of weak responses abroad, the notion somehow or another of being able to preserve something in spite of this powerful, consistent anti-Semitic ideology, and the idea somehow that if we just, in a sense, close one eye, everything eventually will work out. It doesn't. And that is the story we tried to tell in the Third Reich source book. I thank you for your attention. I'm happy to entertain questions or observations.
So,
yeah.
Quite obviously, this is not what you're reading, the whole huge history of racialism.
Yeah.
All this.
Absolutely.
Something like Martin Bernell had a small go at.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, the whole question, therefore, is what are intrinsic distinctions between people? I'm not sure we're very sure of that yet.
Well, in a sense, you've caught the message that I'm hoping that people will get, which is in the age of the new genetics, the idea of race has reappeared. Now, we could have a long discussion about the meaning of race within genetics, but that word has appeared, and people deal with race as if it were something encoded in our DNA, because, of course, they're looking through the lenses, sadly, of the model of race that I've been talking about. In other words, on the one hand, this is a very old story, a story of the 18th century, the 19th century. After 1945, how could anybody believe that? After 1990, suddenly it all comes back. And one is talking about the Jewish race, meaning a biological entity. That's another conversation for another time, but I think you've picked up on exactly what the problematics are. It doesn't go away. It doesn't go away. By the way, good geneticists understand the intense, constant problem of using models which have a long history, to talk about the genetics that they are evolving, literally as we speak. But there ain't good words for it. Right? There ain't good words. So when I started writing about this, I did a book on this topic about contemporary genetics and the idea of resurgence, the idea of race. Some of the geneticists got very perturbed because they said, we don't mean race in that way. And what I said was, you can't use that language and not carry certain of those meanings with. And so some of them, and I think this is lovely, decided they weren't going to talk about race anymore. They were going to talk about ethnicity as a genetic phenomenon, which is even weirder. Which is even weirder, right? Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry. It's my being hard of hearing. If you stood up, I'm sure we all can hear you better. Whatever I say is going to get me in trouble with the Jungians, right? The answer is I don't think there's much of a difference. And that one of the things that happens in 33 is that Jung, who's developed the notion of the collective unconscious well before in the late teens, right, suddenly is confronted with the Nazis, and he sees in their notion of the Volksseele, the collective unconscious. Just as Carl Schmitt, who develops the notion that the political entity has to do with friends defining foes in the early 1920s, suddenly looks at the Nazis and says, oh, you guys are doing that. I like that. In other words, I see in your legal philosophy my legal philosophy. Now, was it the same thing, or in a sense were they projecting this into them? Well, Jung sticks with this a very long time into the 1930s. Carl Schmitt, by the way, even longer, and Heidegger even longer, right? So the answer is it the same thing in 1920? I don't think so. Is it the same thing in 33? Yes, because Jung wants it to be. Right? Now, whether he's right or not is another question, right? And that's a huge debate after 1945 among the Germans. They are really, really torn up about, can you accept this notion of the collective unconscious without talking about the notion of the Volksseele? Right? And what Jung does, and there's an irony in this which is beyond sweet, is that Freud wanted to recruit Jung to have a non-Jewish spokesman. Jung recruits Jews to have a Jewish spokesman for the new Jungian psychoanalysis in the late 40s. As I say, that's beyond sweet. Yeah.
I just wanted to make an observation when you talked about the rootless Jews.
Yeah.
The Zionist movement also looked at the Jews that did not follow their ideology as rootless, as, or even as just a body without a head. And I grew up on a kibbutz in Israel. My parents were Zionists. Yeah. And there is definitely a distinction between the Israelis who are called themselves Canaanites, that sound like really more like the Gentile, while the Jews in the diaspora have different mentality and different psychology. So I was struck by maybe they really picked up from that racial anti-Semitism.
You know, one of the real problems of this kind of work, and my mentor, I mentioned George Mosse before. George Mosse wrote an extraordinary book about the idea of man in the Nazis, the fascists, the communists, and Zionism. And what he points out, of course, is that this all comes out of 19th century racial biology. It all comes out, and that's where Freud is extraordinary. Freud is schooled in this. That is, he goes to the university and he buys textbooks that talks about the Jew as a collective. And if you were a physician, you had to use that. That was part of medicine. Right? Jews have certain diseases. They have certain mental illnesses. They have certain ways of seeing the world. This is the medical textbooks. And Freud reads this, and he has this interesting set of marginalia. He's a student. And basically he says, bullshit, 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 bullshit.
In other words, unlike many of the early Zionists, unlike many of the early fascists, unlike many of the early Nazis, unlike many of the early communists, who believe in this notion of a kind of biological entity that can be reformed and changed, Freud just throws it away. He just says that it's absolutely useless. But that's like human development, right? Not Aryan development. And that's the extraordinary thing about psychoanalysis, is that someone who is writing in 1895, where if you want to become a member of the club, that's what you have to subscribe to. This is the notion of racial identity. Throws it overboard. So the answer is, yeah, there are early, I mean, the person who one always quotes him is because it's embarrassing to him, and after the war, he's embarrassed by it, of course, is Martin Buber. Buber's writings in the 1920s about Jewish identity are, in point of fact, the writings about the Volksseele. And as I say, by the 1950s, he's really embarrassed about it, because he's smart enough to realize that that was a really bad way of imagining Jewish identity. The Germans have a lovely word, which is Jein. Yes and no. What happens after the war, by the way, after the war lasts until the 1980s, let me put it that way. After the war is not 1946, right? Is that there's an attempt by many of the people involved in the Goering Institute, including Goering himself, to say, we were the opposition. Right? We were the opposition, and they integrate the new archaeology into a large number of discussions of psychology and the history of psychology after 1946. So, one of the figures whom I didn't mention today, who becomes extremely important, is the German Enlightenment thinker Carl Philipp Moritz. And these people see Moritz as, in point of fact, the writer of the first case studies. Not Freud, Moritz. And so you get this very odd literature. You have to read the journals. Really interesting. On the one hand, they want to be part of the international psychoanalytic. They become, again, part of the international psychoanalytic. On the other hand, they also want to become somehow or another the German part of the international psychoanalytic. And here's where it gets really creepy. Including, of course, Jewish psychoanalysts who returned to Germany after the war. Right? And again, I'm using the word psychoanalysts in the broadest sense. The case that is the most important are the people from the Frankfurt School who have combined Freud and Marx, right? Like Adorno, who go back to Germany. Right? They're both internationalists and oddly nationalists. This is an interesting story. Never well told. I mean, Cox, and there's a whole debate about this, sort of tells the story up to the 40s. What's much more interesting is 45 to the 1980s, when these guys start to die off, right? And a bunch of people then say, who are these people whom we have been saying sir to? Right? And it happens in psychology, psychiatry, neurology, and psychoanalysis, much later than it does at the universities, where it happened in 68.
Yeah. So, you said about how psychoanalysis was racialized in the process of creating the Goering Institute, yeah. Which was a very pragmatic psychological, you know, therapy. How much can you link the approach of the Goering Institute to sort of the pragmatic types of psychology that sort of dominate psychology today?
Well, again, the easy answer is he's an Adlerian, right? The easy answer is he's an Adlerian. And in the States, less so, I think, than in Europe, the Adlerians become the strand which we call psychiatric social work, right? In other words, they go in the direction of social work and social therapy, rather than the idea of death psychoanalysis, right? So the answer is, that is very powerful after 45. I mean, psychiatric psychotherapy is psychiatric social is very, very important after 1945. It has a space in Germany, too. It has a space in Germany. There are jobs in the hospitals which are filled by people who have that sort of a training. So the answer is, continues absolutely, obviously without the notion of the Volksseele. I mean, that, again, that all disappears as part of the overt rhetoric, 1945. Everybody says, no, it was the other guy who said that. Well, I thank you for your attention. I will point out, because again, this is an infomercial, this makes a lovely Christmas present. it's also, by the way, very inexpensive. We persuaded California to do it for about 45 pounds. And therefore, just as a doorstop, it has value. Good. I thank you all for your attention. We are negotiating with publishers in Germany to do it in a slightly different format. But the answer is, it most probably will, and I'm hoping, therefore, also to be able to expand the section on psychoanalysis, because there's lots of stuff that I could not include, which I really want to include. Yeah. Thank you.
Professor Sandra Dillman, thank you very, very much for a talk that actually exposes some very shocking material, which is also appears in its first form in English as well as in German. But we look forward, I hope that the work will be read and will remind us not to lose sight of what's happened in the very recent history.
Thank you very much.